Chapter 4. Death in a Small Town. 1. Castle Rock has been, at least in recent years, an unlucky town. As if to prove that old saw about lightning and how often it strikes in the same place isn't always right, a number of bad things had happened in Castle Rock over the last 8 or 10 years. Things bad enough to make the national news. George Bannerman was the local sheriff when those things occurred, but Big George, as he had been affectionately called, would not have to deal with Homer Gamache, because Big George was dead. He had survived the first bad thing, a series of rape strangulations committed by one of his own officers, but 2 years later he had been killed by a rabid dog out on Town Road 3. Not just killed either, but almost literally torn apart. Both of these cases had been extremely strange, but the world was a strange place, and a hard one, and sometimes an unlucky one. The new sheriff, he had been in office going on 8 years, but Alan Pangborn had decided he was going to be the new sheriff, at least until the year 2000, always assuming, he told his wife, that he went on running and being elected that long. Hadn't been in Castle Rock then. Until 1980, he had been in charge of highway enforcement in a small, going-on-medium-sized city in upstate New York, not far from Syracuse. Looking at Homer Gamache's battered body, lying in a ditch beside Route 35, he wished he was still there. It looked like not all of the town's bad luck had died with Big George Bannerman, after all. Oh, quit it. You don't wish you were anyplace else on God's green earth. Don't say you do, or bad luck will really come down and take a ride on your shoulder. This has been a damned good place for Annie and the boys, and it's been a damned good place for you, too. So why don't you just get off it? Good advice. Your head, Pangborn had discovered, was always giving your nerves good advice they couldn't take. They said, yes, sir, now that you mention it, that's just as true as it can be. And then they went right on jumping and sizzling. Still, he had been due for something like this, hadn't he? During his tour of duty as sheriff, he had scraped the remains of almost 40 people off the town roads, broken up fights beyond counting, and been faced with maybe 100 cases of spouse and child abuse. And those were just the ones reported. But things have a way of evening out. For a town that had sported its very own mass killer not so long ago, he had had an unusually sweet ride when it came to murder. Just 4, and only one of the perps had run. Joe Rodway, after he blew his wife's brains out. Having had some acquaintance of the lady, Pangborn was almost sorry when he got a telex from the police in Kingston, Rhode Island, saying they had Rodway in custody. One of the others had been vehicular manslaughter, the remaining 2 plain cases of second degree, one with a knife and one with bare knuckles. The latter, a case of spouse abuse that had simply gone too far, having only one odd wrinkle to distinguish it. The wife had beaten the husband to death while he was dead drunk, giving back one final apocalyptic tit for almost 20 years of tat. The woman's last set of bruises had still been a good healthy yellow when she was booked. Pangborn hadn't been a bit sorry when the judge let her off with 6 months in women's correctional, followed by 6 years probation. Judge Pender had probably done that only because it would have been impolitic to give the lady what she really deserved, which was a medal. Small-town murder in real life, he had found, rarely bore any likeness to the small-town murders in Agatha Christie novels, where 7 people all took a turn at stabbing wicked old Colonel Storping Goiter at his country house in Puddleby on the Marsh during a moody winter storm. In real life, Pangborn knew, you almost always arrived to find the perp still standing there, looking down at the mess and wondering what the fuck he'd done. How it had all jittered out of control with such lethal speed. Even if the perp had strolled off, he usually hadn't gone far, and there were 2 or 3 eyewitnesses who could tell you exactly what had happened, who had done it, and where he had gone. The answer to the last question was usually the nearest bar. As a rule, small-town murder in real life was simple, brutal, and stupid. As a rule. But rules are made to be broken. Lightning sometimes does strike twice in the same place, and from time to time murders that happen in small towns are not immediately solvable. Murders like this one. Pangborn could have waited. 2. Officer Norris Ridgwick came back from his cruiser, which was parked behind Pangborn's. Calls from the 2 police band radios crackled out in the warm late spring air. "Is Ray coming?" Pangborn asked. Ray was Ray Van Allen, Castle County's medical examiner and coroner.
Yep, Nora said.
What about Homer's wife? Anybody tell her about this yet? Pangborn waved flies away from Homer's upturned face as he spoke. There was not much left but the beaky, jutting nose. If not for the prosthetic left arm and the gold teeth which had once been in Gamache's mouth, and now lay in splinters on his wattled neck and the front of his shirt, Pangborn doubted if his own mother would have known him. Norris Ridgwick, who bore a passing resemblance to Deputy Barney Fife on the old Andy Griffith show, scuffled his feet and looked down at his shoes as if they had suddenly become very interesting to him.
"Well, John's on patrol up in the View, and Andy Clutterbuck's in Auburn at District Court."
Pangborn sighed and stood up. Gamache was, had been, 67 years old. He'd lived with his wife in a small, neat house by the old railroad depot less than 2 miles from here. Their children were grown and gone away. It was Mrs. Gamache who had called the sheriff's office early this morning, not crying but close, saying she'd wakened at 7 to find that Homer, who sometimes slept in one of the kids' old rooms because she snored, hadn't come home at all last night. He had left for his league bowling at 7 the previous evening, just like always, and should have been home by midnight, 12:30 at the latest. But the beds were all empty and his truck wasn't in the dooryard or the garage. Sheila Brigham, the day dispatcher, had relayed the initial call to Sheriff Pangborn, and he had used the payphone at Sunny Jacket's Sunoco station, where he had been gassing up, to call Mrs. Gamache back. She had given him what he needed on the truck, Chevrolet pickup, 1971, white with maroon primer paint on the rust spots and a gun rack in the cab, main license number 96529Q. He'd put it out on the radio to his officers in the field, only 3 of them, with Cluck testifying up in Auburn, and told Mrs. Gamache he would get back to her just as soon as he had something. He hadn't been particularly worried. Gamache liked his beer, especially on his league bowling night, but he wasn't completely foolish. If he'd had too much to feel safe driving, he would have slept on the couch in one of his bowling buddies' living rooms. There was one question, though. If Homer had decided to stay at the home of a teammate, why hadn't he called his wife and told her so? Didn't he know she'd worry? Well, it was late, and maybe he didn't want to disturb her. That was one possibility. A better one, Pangborn thought, was that he had called and she had been fast asleep in bed, a closed door between her and the one telephone in the house. And you had to add in the probability that she was snoring like a Jimmy Pete doing 70 on the turnpike. Pangborn had said goodbye to the distraught woman and hung up, thinking her husband would show by 11 o'clock this morning at the latest, shamefaced and more than a little hungover. Ellen would give the old rip the sandpaper side of her tongue when he did. Pangborn would thus make it a point to commend Homer, quietly, for having the sense not to drive the 30 miles between South Paris and Castle Rock while under the influence. About an hour after Ellen Gamache's call, it had occurred to him that something wasn't right about his first analysis of the situation. If Gamache had slept over at a bowling buddy's house, it seemed to Alan that it must have been the first time he ever did so. Otherwise, his wife would have thought of it herself and at least waited a while longer before calling the sheriff's office. And then it struck Alan that Homer Gamache was a little bit old to be changing his ways. If he had slept over someplace last night, he should have done it before, but his wife's call suggested he hadn't. If he had gotten shit-faced at the lanes before and then driven home that way, he probably would have done it again last night. But hadn't. So the old dog learned a new trick after all, he thought. It happens. Or maybe he just drank more than usual. Hell, he might even have drunk about the same amount as always and gotten drunker than usual. They say it does catch up with a person. He had tried to forget Homer Gamache, at least for the time being. He had yay paperwork on his desk, and sitting there, rolling a pencil back and forth and thinking about that old geezer out someplace in his pickup truck, that old geezer with white hair buzzed flat in a crew cut, and a mechanical arm on account of he'd lost the real one at a place called Pusan in an undeclared war which had happened when most of the current crop of Vietnam vets were still shitting yellow in their dighties. Well, none of that was moving the paper on his desk, and it wasn't finding Gamache either.
All the same, he had been walking over to Sheila Brigham's little cubbyhole, meaning to ask her to raise Norris Ridgwick so he could find out if Norris had found anything out, when Norris himself had called in. What Norris had to report deepened Alan's trickle of unease to a cold and steady stream. It ran through his guts and made him feel lightly numb. He scoffed at those people who talked about telepathy and precognition on the call-in radio programs, scoffed in the way people do when hint and hunch have become so much a part of their lives that they barely recognize them when they are using them. But if asked what he believed about Homer Gamache at that moment, Alan would have replied, "When Norris called in, well, that's when I started knowing the old man was hurt bad or dead. Probably choice number two." 3. Norris had happened to stop at the Arsenault place on Route 35 about a mile south of Homeland Cemetery. He hadn't even been thinking about Homer Gamache, although the Arsenault farm and Homer's place were less than 3 miles apart, and if Homer had taken the logical route home from South Paris the night before, he would have passed the Arsenaults. It didn't seem likely to Norris that any of the Arsenaults would have seen Homer the night before, because if they had, Homer would have arrived home safe and sound 10 minutes or so later. Norris had only stopped at the Arsenault farm because they kept the best roadside produce stand in the three towns. He was one of those rare bachelors who liked to cook, and he had developed a terrific hankering for fresh sugar peas. He had wanted to find out when the Arsenaults would have some for sale. As an afterthought, he'd asked Dolly Arsenault if she had happened to see Homer Gamache's truck the night before. "Now you know," Mrs. Arsenault had said. "It's funny you should mention that, because I did. Late last night. No, now that I think about it, it was early this morning because Johnny Carson was still on, but getting toward the end. I was going to have another bowl of ice cream and watch a little of that David Letterman show and then go to bed. I don't sleep so well these days, and that man on the other side of the road put my nerves up." "What man was that, Mrs. Arsenault?" Norris asked, suddenly interested. "I don't know, just some man. I didn't like his looks. Couldn't even hardly see him, and I didn't like his looks. How's that? Sounds bad, I know, but that Juniper Hill Mental Asylum isn't all that far away. And when you see a man alone on a country road at almost 1 in the morning, it's enough to make anyone nervous, even if he is wearing a suit." "What kind of a suit was he wear—" Norris began, but it was useless. Mrs. Arsenault was a fine old country talker, and she simply rolled over Norris Ridgwick with a kind of relentless grandiosity. He decided to wait her out and glean what he could along the way. He took his notebook out of his pocket. "In a way," she went on, "the suit almost made me more nervous. It didn't seem right for a man to be wearing a suit at that hour, if you see what I mean. Probably you don't. Probably you think I'm just a silly old woman, and probably I am just a silly old woman. But for a minute or two before Homer come along, I had an idea that man was maybe going to come to the house, and I got up to make sure the door was locked. He looked over this way, you know. I saw him do that. I imagine he looked because he could probably see the window was still lighted even though it was late. Probably could see me, too, because the curtains are only shears. I couldn't really see his face. No moon out last night, and I don't believe they'll ever get streetlights out this far, let alone cable TV like they have in town. But I could see him turn his head. Then he did start to cross the road. At least I think that was what he was doing, or was thinking about doing, if you see what I mean. And I thought he would come and knock on the door and say his car was broke down and could he use the phone. And I was wondering what I should say if he did that, or even if I should answer the door. I suppose I am a silly old woman, because I got thinking about that Alfred Hitchcock Presents show, where there was a crazy man who could just about charm the birdies down from the trees. Only he'd use an axe to chop somebody all up, you know, and he put the pieces in the trunk of his car. And they only caught him because one of his taillights was out, or something like that. But the other side of it was, Mrs. Arsenault, I wonder if I could ask, was that I didn't want to be like the Philistine or Saracen or Gomorrah or whoever it was that passed by on the other side of the road," Mrs. Arsenault continued. "You know, in the story of the Good Samaritan. So I was in a little bit of a tither about it. But I said to myself..." By then Norris had forgotten all about sugar peas. He was finally able to bring Mrs. Arsenault to a stop by telling her that the man she had seen might figure in what he called an ongoing investigation. He got her to back up to the beginning and tell him everything she had seen, leaving out Alfred Hitchcock Presents and the story of the Good Samaritan as well, if possible. The story, as he related it over the radio to Sheriff Alan Pangborn, was this. She had been watching The Tonight Show alone, her husband and the boys asleep in bed. Her chair was by the window, which looked out on Route 35. The shade was up. Around 12:30 or 12:40, she had looked up and had seen a man standing on the far side of the road, which was to say the Homeland Cemetery side. Had the man walked from that direction or the other? Mrs. Arsenault couldn't say for sure. She had an idea he might have come from the direction of Homeland, which would have meant he was heading away from town, but she couldn't say for sure what gave her that impression, because she had looked out the window once and only seen the road, then looked out again before getting up to get her ice cream, and he was there. Just standing there and looking toward the lighted window. Toward her, presumably. She thought he was going to cross the road, or had started to cross the road. Probably just stood there, Alan thought. The rest was nothing but the woman's nerves talking. When lights showed on the crest of the hill. When the man in the suit saw the approaching lights, he had cocked his thumb in the timeless, stateless gesture of the hitchhiker. "It was Homer's truck, all right, and Homer at the wheel," Mrs. Arsenault told Norris Ridgwick. "At first I thought he'd just go on by, like any normal person who sees a hitchhiker in the middle of the night. But then his taillights flashed on, and that man ran up to the passenger side of the cab and got in." Mrs. Arsenault, who was 46 and looked 20 years older, shook her white head. "Homer must have been lit to pick up a hitchhiker that late," she told Norris. "Lit or simple-minded, and I've known Homer almost 35 years. He ain't simple." She paused for thought. "Well, not very." Norris tried to get a few more details from Mrs. Arsenault on the suit the man had been wearing, but had no luck. He thought it really was sort of a pity that the street lamps ended at the Homeland Cemetery grounds, but small towns like The Rock had only so much money to do with. It had been a suit, she was sure of that, not a sport coat or a man's jacket, and it hadn't been black, but that left quite a spectrum of colors to choose from. Mrs. Arsenault didn't think the hitchhiker's suit had been pure white, but all she was willing to swear to was that it hadn't been black.
"I'm not actually asking you to swear, Mrs. A.," Nora said. "When a body's speaking with an officer of the law on official business," Mrs. A. replied, folding her hands primly into the arms of her sweater, "it comes to the same thing."
So what she knew boiled down to this. She had seen Homer Gamache pick up a hitchhiker at about 12:45 in the morning. Nothing to call in the FBI about, you would have said. It only got ominous when you added in the fact that Homer had picked up his passenger 3 miles or less from his own dooryard, but hadn't arrived home. Mrs. Arsenault was right about the suit, too. Seeing a hitchhiker this far out in the boonies in the middle of the night was odd enough. By 12:45, any ordinary drifter would have laid up in a deserted barn or some farmer's shed. But when you added in the fact that he had also been wearing a suit and a tie, "Some dark color," Mrs. A. said. "Just don't ask me to swear what dark color, because I can't and I won't." It got less comfortable all the time. "What do you want me to do next?" Norris had asked over the radio once his report was complete. "Stay where you are," Alan said. "Swap Alfred Hitchcock Presents stories with Mrs. A. until I get there. I always used to like those myself." But before he had gone half a mile, the location of the meeting between himself and his officer had been changed from the Arsenault place to a spot about a mile west of there. A boy named Frank Gavineau, walking home from a little early fishing down at Strimmer's Brook, had seen a pair of legs protruding from the high weeds on the south side of Route 35. He ran home and told his mother. She had called the sheriff's office. Sheila Brigham relayed the message to Alan Pangborn and Norris Ridgwick. Sheila maintained protocol and mentioned no names on the air. Too many little pitchers with big cobras and bearcats were always listening in on the police bands. But Alan could tell by the upset tone of Sheila's voice that even she had a good idea who those legs belonged to. About the only good thing which had happened all morning was that Norris had finished emptying his stomach before Alan got there, and had maintained enough wit to throw up on the north side of the road, away from the body and any evidence there might be around it. "What now?" Norris asked, interrupting the run of his thoughts.
Alan sighed heavily and quit waving the flies away from Homer's remains. It was a losing battle.
Now I get to go down the road and tell Ellen Gamache the Widowmaker paid a visit early this morning.
You stay here with the body. Try to keep the flies off him.
Gee, Sheriff, why? There's an awful lot of them.
And he's dead. Yeah, I can see that.
I don't know why. Because it just seems like the right thing to do, I guess. We can't put his fucking arm back on, but at least we can keep the flies from shitting on what's left of his nose.
Okay, Norris said humbly. Okay, Sheriff.
Norris, do you think you could call me Alan if you really worked on it? If you practiced?
Sure, Sheriff, I guess so.
Alan grunted and turned for one last look at the area of the ditch that would, in all probability, be cordoned off with bright yellow crime scene do not cross tapes attached to surveyor's poles when he got back. The county coroner would be here. Henry Payton from the Oxford State Police Barracks would be here. The photographer and the technicians from the Attorney General's Capital Crimes Division probably wouldn't be, unless there happened to be a couple of them in the area already on another case, but they would arrive shortly after. By 1 p.m, the state police's rolling lab would be here too, complete with hot and cold running forensics experts and a guy whose job it was to mix up plaster and take moulage casts of the tire prints Norris had either been smart enough or lucky enough not to run over with the wheels of his own cruiser. Alan opted rather reluctantly for lucky.
And what would it all come to?
Why, just this. A half-drunk old man had stopped to do a favor for a stranger.
Hop on up here, boy, Alan could hear him saying. I ain't going only a couple of miles, but I'll get you a little further on your way.
And the stranger had responded by beating the old man to death and then stealing his truck. He guessed the man in the business suit had asked Homer to pull over. The most likely pretext would have been to say he needed to take a leak, and once the truck was stopped, he'd clipped the old man, dragged him out, and... but that was when it got bad. So very goddamn bad. Alan looked down into the ditch one final time to where Norris Ridgwick squatted by the bloody piece of meat that had been a man, patiently waving the flies away from what had been Homer's face with his citation clipboard, and felt his stomach turn over again. He was just an old man, you son of a whore. An old man who was half in the bag and only had one honest arm to boot. An old man whose one little pleasure left was his bowling league night. So why didn't you just clip him that one good one in the cab of his truck and then leave him be? It was a warm night, and even if it had been a little chilly, he most likely would have been okay. I'd bet my watch we're going to find a whole lot of antifreeze in his system. And the truck's license plate number goes out on the wire either way. So why this? Man, I hope I get a chance to ask you. But did the reason matter? It sure didn't to Homer Gamache. Not anymore. Nothing was ever going to matter to Homer again. Because after clipping him that first one, the hitchhiker had pulled him out of the cab and dragged him into the ditch, probably hauling him by the armpits. Alan didn't need the boys from Capital Crimes to read the marks left by the heels of Gamache's shoes. Along the way, the hitcher had discovered Homer's disability. And at the bottom of the trench, he had wrenched the old man's prosthetic arm from his body and bludgeoned him to death with it.